These are the basics for what moves the judge and jury. These are the ideas that motivate people. These are the things that make them want you to win. These are the things that make the jury take sides and judges to take sides. And now I want you to help me do something. I want you to brainstorm with me the theory of a case. I told you we're going to have some fun, and we sure are. We're going to brainstorm a theory, and to set it up, I'm going to tell you about this case. I'm going to do what in the vernacular is a lunchbox job. I'm going to do an awful opening statement that will give you the underlying facts, give you the legal theory, but will do none of, or almost none of, the good things that we're talking about. Okay? Here we go. Tell you what, I would like you to be the president of the plaintiff corporation. I want you to be Mark Willis, okay? And I'll just point to you. You're my client. Ladies and gentlemen, I am here on behalf of the plaintiff in this cause of action, which is based on a breach of contract. I am here representing the Willis Construction Company Incorporated, and it in turn is represented by its president and chief executive officer, Mr. Mark Willis, the gentleman who's seated at the council table right here. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a breach of contract case in which an agreement was entered into by and between the party of the first part, that is the plaintiff in the cause of action, the Willis Construction Company Incorporated, the party of the second part, which is the supplier of goods and materials, the Tri-City Lumber and Supply Company. The evidence will show that on or about the 15th of September, 1990, an agreement was entered into by and between the Willis Construction Company and the Tri-City Lumber and Supply Company for the supply of in excess of 100,000 board feet of wood to be delivered to the construction site of the Willis Construction Company at Pebble Park, a new development on the north side of town. The evidence will further show that the 100,000 board feet of wood and other building materials were to cost an agreed sum of in excess of $750,000. The evidence will further show that the materials were to be delivered on or about the 15th of March, 1991. The evidence will further show that on or about the 15th of March, 1991, the defendant wholly failed, neglected, refused, and omitted to comply with the terms of that agreement. As a result of which, the Willis Construction Company Incorporated was forced to obtain substitute performance, that is, cover under the Uniform Commercial Code, by obtaining supplies from other suppliers. The evidence will show that there was an additional cost for the substitute performance in excess of $250,000, which was the expectancy of the plaintiff in this cause. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, he has been damaged by the breach of this contract, the extent of $250,000, and we will ask judgment in that sum at the end of all the evidence. Thank you very much. Well, you may have heard worse openings. I mean, I'm sorry that there are worse openings. I would hope that's the worst you've heard. It's not the worst I've heard. I recall one in Cleveland. We have in Ohio an assured clear distance statute that says that when you're driving a car, you must maintain an assured clear distance in front of you. And it makes presumptively your rear-ending of anybody else presumptively negligent. And so a plaintiff's lawyer stood up and said, ladies and gentlemen, this is an assured clear distance case. Wow, that really explained it, didn't it? Now, here I have this awful opening. It was not intended to be an example except as a bad example. It was intended to communicate to you. However, because you're all trained lawyers, you know what this case is now about. It's about a breach of contract. It's about the supply of materials for a builder. And the supplier didn't deliver as agreed, and so he had to get other supplies from other suppliers, and it cost more money. And now he wants the difference. And you know that. And now let's brainstorm the case. I suggest that the very word contract's a bad word. I'm serious about that. Contract to you says, a consensual agreement entered into between people of equal bargaining power by which they hammer out their rights and responsibilities. Only in your dreams. What's the contract to the people in the jury? What's the contract? Contract something imposed on them by somebody with superior bargaining power who says sign it or you don't get the car. Who says sign it or you don't get the apartment. Who says sign it or you don't get this. Sign it or you don't get that. A contract is something imposed on you by which your rights are limited by somebody with superior bargaining power. Contract is not your word. Contract is not your term. Contract does not excite the sense of injustice by any means. There are even darker secondary connotations to contract. With people whose last names end in vowel, contracts are agreements by which people are removed from this mortal coil. Oh, yeah. Almost nothing good about the word contract at all. All of the good that you see is out of your sheltered middle or upper middle class environment and your extensive educational background and the interests that you've been serving for a number of years. Contract is not a good jury word. So what I want you to do for the purpose of seeing how the language of persuasion will drive the story that paints the picture of unfairness. We're going to brainstorm it. And we're going to have other words. And I'm going to get up here and you're going to shout out words that we will use instead of contract. Now, I want to hear any word, no matter how ridiculous you think it is. I want to hear any substitute for contract, whether they think it's good or bad. And I want you to understand that in brainstorming, there are no wrong answers. You have all answers first because it encourages a listing of all possible responses. And then you cull, then you sift. But first, you write them all down. So, other words, yes. Pardon me? Promise, okay? Promise. Let's have another one. Agreement. Okay, you're doing great. Bargain and then deal. Gave word. Well, let me just write down word. Okay. Handshake. I'll just write down hand quicker. Pardon me? Pact. Okay. Understanding. Commitment. Some more. Expectation. I'll just write expect. Make it quick. Any more? Pardon me? Requirement. Anybody want to say covenant? Okay, obligation. I'll put down covenant. I'll suggest it. Even though we may later take it out. Any more? Pardon me? Duty. Okay, we got a lot of words with which to work. But before we start culling, I would now like to move over to breach of contract. Why is it wrong that there is a breach of contract? How is somebody hurt by a breach of contract? I mean, this is focusing in on what this case is all about. If we're going to show that there's an injustice, that there's a wrong, we have to show why it's wrong. It's like Dan Webb showed why it's wrong to lie to Congress. We got to show why it's wrong to breach your contract. Yes. They're cheated. Okay? All right, cheat. How are they cheated? Reliance. Okay. Well, how can you rely on what somebody else's word is? What do you have to do to rely? Trust. What do you have to do to trust somebody? Believe. All right. And other ways to say that are to count on. You got a lot of words here to work with. I think we have enough for now. Unless somebody wants to suggest more that I've missed. I think we have enough to go ahead. And undoubtedly, there are more words. And I want you to do this with every case you have, to develop a vocabulary for the sense of injustice for every case that you have. Because you are explaining your ideas to non-lawyers. And you have to touch on their stories and their belief structures. And if you don't, you're not being bilingual. You've got to be bilingual. All right, now let's start the call. Promise, lovely word. I see no downsides to promise. Agreement. An agreement suggests consensual mutual bargaining power. That's got a lot of nice things to it, doesn't it? Bargain. Well, we have a bargain. In that sense, it's a good word. But bargain also has Kmart overtones. Bargain also has the bargain basement overtones. It has the advantageous price that is yours through fluke, which you, in a sense, don't deserve, but you chance on by luck. And implied in bargain are some downsides that make it a word that you ought to be careful with. I'm not saying don't use it, but be careful with it. Deal. People deal cards. People deal drugs. You got a real deal. Deal has secondary overtones like bargain, and it also has some darker overtones that suggest less savory kinds of activities. I'm not saying it's a bad word. I'm saying be careful because of secondary overtones. Word. Powerful, because enters personal integrity. With your word, you are giving a personal moral commitment to keep your promise, just like promise. But word, because it's so short, seems to have, at least to me and a lot of people, more emotional punch than promise. Well, you made a promise, but we can't always keep our promises. Word seems to be a different kind of promise, doesn't it? Why? I'm not quite certain I can articulate it exactly, but I will tell you it was no mistake that Joe Gemmell's theory of the case in Texaco versus Pennzoil was your word is your bond. That theme of that case was worth over $10 billion. It was not something he just happened to pick on when he rose to give his opening statement. It was thought out carefully in advance by a brainstorming process like this. Hand. They shook on it, gave their handshake. Pact. Pact does not speak to me the same way that word does. Although it's only four letters, it looks like a newspaper headline word. Something that people don't use all the time, but it saves space and it makes you think about it. And it takes a while to process. Pact. Pact. Sometimes pacts are unholy alliances for reasons I don't know. Maybe it's the kind of stories newspapers write. I wouldn't use pact, but I would sure write it down and think about it. Understanding. Understanding suggests that the process was deliberative. Now, that's good. But they didn't just snap on this. They reached an understanding, and that suggests give and take, doesn't it? Commitment. You make a commitment. When you are committed to something, you are bound, you're restrained. Commitment also has secondary overtones about being thrown in the funny house. People aren't going to think of that immediately, but some people on the jury, that'll pass through their minds. So commitment has a sense of bindingness on it that doesn't, to me, convey quite the power of word or promise. Expect an expectation. Expect an expectation. Expectation is a long word. Expect means you're kind of hoping for. Doesn't have the strength of rely and trust and believe and count on. Requirement. You're required to do something is what's suggested there. And it doesn't have this notion of a solemn undertaking. So I don't know that it helps us, although it's not a bad word. It doesn't hurt us. Obligation. You're obliged to do this. You're obligated. You have committed yourself, therefore you're obligated. You're now under kind of a form of coercion, and it doesn't focus on the reliance. It focuses on almost the duress that you're under. I think obligation is not a strong plaintiff word. It's not a strong defense word either. I like the simpler words like word and promise and count on and duty and rely and trust and believe. Covenant, I put it up there myself for you to see. Covenant is solemn. It's used in religious circles all the time. You would think that maybe it would gather some of that religious commitment and take it with it's the word to the contract. I don't think so. I leave it out. I wouldn't use it. Okay? Now, with that, let's tell the story as an opening using these words. Now, let's back up the story a little bit. Let's humanize our client a little bit. And after all, this is a mom-and-pop construction company. It hasn't been going for very long. This guy used to be a carpenter who worked for another construction company. He started his own business about 6-7 years ago. And he was making patios and doing home repairs. And he wanted to get into whole house construction. And this was the first construction contract he had. All right. There's a little bit of the historical background. And we're going to put that in the opening statement. Okay? So let's just tell the story of the Willis Construction Company and Mark Willis, his wife Helen, got a couple of kids. If I need to talk about them, I'll Chuck, Mary. I don't know if I'll need to talk about them. Ladies and gentlemen, I am here to speak for the Willis Construction Company and Mr. Mark Willis. Who is the Willis Construction Company? He's the gentleman seated here. He and his wife, Helen, are the owners and operators of the Willis Construction Company. They have come here to ask you to right a wrong. This case starts 7 years ago when Mark got out of the Army and was working as a carpenter for a construction company, and he wanted to start his own business. And he and Helen saved their money. And they used to dream about what it would be like to have the Willis Construction Company instead of Mark just working for other people. 5 years ago, they had saved enough money to take the chance. And they were seated around the kitchen table. And Helen said, Mark, let's go for it. Let's do it. And they did. They borrowed the money and they started the company. And that's the Willis Construction Company. At first, they were just making porches and patios, and they wanted, it was their dream, to build houses and make homes for people to live in. 2 years ago, in the summer of 1990, they got their chance. Pebble Park on the north side of town, this new development, you've probably seen it, heard about it, had cornered most of the contractors in town. And had commitments for all of the housing spots except an even dozen. And these were not contracted for. And they called Mark and they invited him to bid on those 12 houses. And he came home and he said, Helen, we got our chance. She says, Mark, let's go for it. I don't know how many more crew members you need or how much we need to borrow, but let's do it. And so he said, yeah, I'm going to bid on it. And if I'm going to bid on it, I'm going to have a supply of materials from someplace I can count on. I've heard about Tri-City Lumber and Supply. They're supposed to be the best. And that's where he went. Tri-City Lumber and Supply. You've seen their ads on television, Trust the Man with the Yellow Hat. They advertise in the late night movies. That's where Mark went. And when he got there, he had the list of all of the things that he had to have, his requirements for this job, things that he needed to build a house. And he talked to a fellow named Max Jason. He says, Mr. Jason, these are the things I need to bid on 12 houses at Pebble Park. Give me a good price, because I'm going to base my bid on what you tell me. And if I get the bid, if I get the contract, I'm buying from you. So give me a good price. They came back with a computer printout that was 28 pages long. And they said, Mr. Willis, the things that you want are going to total nearly $750,000. Well, Mark gulped. $750,000 was a lot of money. He said, well, if that's what it's going to cost, that's what it's going to cost. Let's shake on it. And they did. And then Mark said, well, you got my word. If I get the bid, I'm going to buy from you. He says, tell you what, we ought to put it in writing. And so Maxwell Jason took this computer printout that he had given to Mark, and he wrote on the bottom of it, for March 15th, 1991 delivery. And he signed it, Maxwell Jason. He said, there, we got a deal. Mark trusted their promise. He believed that they would do what they said they would. He took them at their word. And so, relying on what they had said to him, he went out and he hired the additional workers that he needed. He went out and he contracted for 12 basements to be dug. He went out and he contracted for 12 basements to be poured. He contracted for the 12 sewer lines and water mains to be put in and the power to be set up. And he did all of that, trusting Tri-City Lumber and Supply to keep their promise and deliver the wood when the day came. And now it's March 1991. Winter's just barely broken. He's ready to start construction. He's got his crews at the site. The basements are in place, but there are no materials. He calls Tri-City Lumber and Supply. He says, look, there's Mark Willis out here at Pebble Park. We've been waiting for that wood to come. And they said, I'm sorry, who are you speaking with? And he said, that fellow Jason, Maxwell Jason, is he there? They put him on hold for 20 minutes and play Muzak. Finally, Maxwell Jason gets on and says, oh, you want that wood? He said, well, I'm sorry, but the price has gone up. He says, you can't do this to me. You made a promise. He said, I'm sorry, but the price of wood has gone up. If you want the wood, it's going to cost you more money. It's going to cost you $400,000 more. Just $400,000 rise. You can't do that. You made a promise. He said, I got people counting on me. I got workers waiting to build these houses. Said, if you want the wood, you better act quickly because the price is rising still. Well, now he had to scramble. There was no way he could pay $400,000 more additional than what he'd promised. So he went around looking for other suppliers, and he got it. He found other wood, he found other suppliers, and he got it not for $400,000 more. He got it for $250,000 more, a quarter of a million more than had been promised by Tri-City. Mark kept his word. He built those houses, as he said, according to specification, at the price he promised to build them for. And every penny of profit and a lot more was lost. And what was to have made him some money was nearly an economic disaster. And now he has come here asking you to right this wrong, asking you to tell Tri-City Lumber and Supply. You broke your word. You're going to have to keep it. You're going to have to pay what you cost Mark Willis, $250,000. At the end of all the proof, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to ask you for a judgment in that amount. All right. Now, the reason that I chose this, we're done. I tried to use the words that we agreed on up here. And to some extent, I was successful. In other extents, there's some that I could have used more. But the reason I chose a commercial case is that it has no inherent sex appeal. Not like a leg off. It's not like this, that somebody waiting for the bus who puts his hand on the main beam of the kiosk and gets electrocuted with 22,000 volts going through him just like that, which happened in Cleveland a couple of years ago. This is not one of these things where somebody's instantly made a paraplegic or a quadriplegic that has this inherent pathos to it. This is just a dumb construction supply case. But I wanted you to see that the sense of injustice was there. It's your job to put it there. It's your job to brainstorm the case so that the judge and jury see that it's there. All right? That's what this is all about, is shaping the case so that it draws on these things. You've got to create the language yourself. It will not come to you for crying out loud in the middle of trial. You have to go in with a vocabulary list. The vocabulary drives the apparent content of the story. It does, doesn't it? You got to pick that vocabulary first, and you have to be very critical and evaluative about every term that you pick. You got to list them all first. You got to brainstorm it just like I did right now. Do you do this in a products liability case? Oh, yeah. One time for the defendant to demonstrate an opening statement in a big nationwide products liability case. I sat down with two other lawyers. We had dinner and we spent all night listing words and evaluating them just to describe the plaintiff's conduct and whether the plaintiff's conduct was operative in an emotional sense so that they shouldn't be able to blame the defendant. And picking those words, what a delightful evening it was. I mean, this was just fascinating, tossing ideas back and forth, writing down every possible word, and then formulating them in phrases and testing what we thought against what we knew from the jury surveys and against what we understood people's psychology and inner scripts to be, to come up with a handful of phrases. And that's what lawyering's all about. And if you can't bill the time for that, then there's something wrong with the structure of your firm, because this is the most important lawyering you'll ever do. This is when you are at the cusp of the theory of the case, the legal theory of the case, and articulating it right so it will deal with that sense of injustice. Okay? That's what you're doing. That's the magic of it. That's what you're here to see. And what we've just done is at the heart of it all. We've got more to talk about, but brainstorming the language of the case is absolutely key. Okay?
This is the end of Tape 3, Side 1. The program continues on Side 2.
Let's turn on and go to the theme. Do you have a theme? Oh, yeah, the theory of the case is the story, but you want to epitomize the story. Now, you got to be careful. You don't want to be cute. If you're cute, your advocacy shows. The storytelling is no longer transparent. It is painfully aware to everybody that you are being an advocate. Cute phrases are mistakes. Be careful with alliteration. And be careful with images that apparently don't make sense. For example, this is the case of the flying refrigerator. That's too cute. I don't care what the theory of the case is. I don't care what's going on. It's cute. It's obviously an attempt to play on words and create an artificial interest. On the other hand, your word is your bond. That's the theme in Pennzoil versus Texaco, no question about it. Robert Service wrote a poem. Jim James, talking about contract cases, likes to use one of Service's phrases from The Cremation of Sam McGee. Robert Service wrote that. Starts out, the northern lights have seen strange sights and all of that, but the strangest they ever did see was that night on the marge of Lake LaBarge when I cremated Sam McGee. Well, that's not how Jim Jean starts out. He starts out with a phrase from that poem. That's folk wisdom. A promise made is a debt unpaid. Now, that's memorable, but it's just hokey enough to not be cute. And Jim Jeans can use it, and it's lovely, okay? The theme is the theory of the case epitomized by a phrase, and often the time for the theme is at the very beginning. Let me show you, for the defendant, the theme in a pedestrian rundown. The case is Potter versus Schrackel. It's a NIDA case. Charlie Schrackel, driving the Schrackel Construction Company truck, was in NIDA City, it's really Champaign-Urbana, on Kirby Avenue, turning left off of Kirby onto Mattis, and he hits Catherine Potter. He doesn't see her before he hits her. She goes flying into the air, slams back down on the hood of his truck, falls to the ground, bangs her head on the ground, cracks her head, and she dies of what is called a subdural hematoma, meaning her brain was bleeding, and the pressure from that, together with the swelling of the brain, killed her. Now, that's how Catherine Potter died, and that's what happened in this case. And we will assume that the plaintiff has just done a dynamite job of doing an opening statement describing how Charlie Schrackel, driving this truck into the sun, turning left, doesn't even see Catherine Potter before he hits her. Even after he hits her, when she's flying in the air and falling on the hood, he doesn't see her. He doesn't see her until after he gets out of the truck, goes to the front of the truck, and there she is lying underneath the front of the truck. And we've had this story told, and now we got to deal with this. And what's our theme? What's our theory? Well, the lawyer who did this in a demonstration at NIDA thought a long time about the golden rule. You know what the golden rule is? It's an anti-plaintiff rule. It says that it's wrong for you to ask, especially in a personal injury case, the jury to put themselves in the shoes of either party, but particularly the plaintiff. And it comes from the corn picker cases and the actions against John Deere, where the plaintiff would get up and say, "Folks, we're here for Lefty Wiggins, who lost his right arm to a John Deere corn picker. Now, we're going to ask you for $7 million for that right arm. And if there's anybody here who would sell your right arm for $7 million, raise your left hand." Okay, now that's an improper opening. You can't do that. That is the golden rule. Perversely called the golden rule, because you are not permitted to say, "Do unto the plaintiff as you would want done unto you." Now, I want you to observe something. The golden rule says you can't say it. It doesn't say they can't do it. It doesn't say you can't give your opening statement so that they put themselves in the plaintiff's shoes. And after all, the sense of injustice says that they will do it. What you want to do is get them there without asking them to do it directly. And so the lawyer who put together this opening statement wanted the jury to think of themselves as driving this truck without saying, "Hey, it could have been you." I want you to hear just the first words of this opening statement. "Ladies and gentlemen, this case is about something that anyone who has ever driven a truck or a car, any motor vehicle, has dreaded. This case is about jaywalking. And the young man that fate chose to be behind the wheel of his truck, when a woman stepped out in his path right in the middle of the street under circumstances where he never had a chance to see. The woman who stepped right in his path. The official name of this case is Potter versus the Schrackel Construction Company Incorporated. Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to meet the Schrackel Construction Company. Charlie? All right, stop there. You got some personification of the defendant as a mom and pop operation, which you want to do if you can. And you have got, it could have been you. Now, that opening statement says it, but it doesn't say it directly. It says it indirectly. Does this slop over the line as far as some judges are concerned? Probably. But it's not a common law crime. It's not malum in se. It is your job to get that jury in his shoes if you can, to identify with the fact that it could have been anyone. And if what she did was jaywalk in the middle of the street and just step off the midline or step off the curb into the path of a truck, he's not at fault. And it says it like that. And it puts you in the driver's seat, not by open invitation, but by characterization. This is something that anyone's ever driven a car has dreaded, jaywalking. And instantly in your mind is what? You're driving down a suburban street and a little kid jumps out between two cars chasing a ball. You slam on your brakes, but you can't stop in time. That's your picture. That's your script, because you have stopped in time and you have thanked God as you went away from there that your eye was quick enough and you're praying that it should never happen that close again. Right? That opening statement was designed to evoke that script. Whether it did depends on the circumstances and on the scripts that are there. All right? You want to have a theme. The theme can be something like risks and responsibilities in a products liability case. We're never going to make the perfectly safe car. There are always risks. And because there are risks, there are responsibilities. And you can stand up and give your opening statement without giving that mini argument that I gave, and write down the words risks and responsibilities and start giving your opening statement. And that theme of risks and the responsibilities that go with those risks is talking the whole time. Okay? I want you to have a theme. I want you to have a simple idea that carries this. Okay? And I want you to articulate it at the very beginning. The choice of the theory of the case should take hours, nay, days. The words that articulate the theme and you give in the first 30 seconds to 1 minute of your opening is worth several hours. And when you explain this case to other people, you will practice refining that theme, so that it communicates and it persuades at once without being obvious, overwhelming, jabbing in the ribs kind of, you gotta find for the poor widow and orphan. You know, when you put Tiny Tim's crutch in the corner, when you whip out the violin and start playing Hearts and Flowers, you lost them. They're not with you. They discount it. They think you're a charlatan playing on their emotions and they resent it. Okay. Focus. Every direct and cross-examination should have a focus. Now, it should go with your theory of the case. If you're doing a direct or a cross-examination that doesn't go with your theory of the case, don't do it. Either it advances your theory of the case or you shouldn't be doing it. It's that simple. Now, I want you to see that in addition to advancing the theory of the case, you want to have a focus for your direct and cross-examination. And in your trial notebook, you will have a section for every witness. What's in that section for the witness? Well, an outline of the deposition, the outline of your direct and cross or cross-examination. A data sheet, call it the focus sheet, that has the demographics about the person, the main objectives that you want to accomplish on your cross or direct, and the focus. And the focus is different than the main objective. The main objective may be to, for example, on the cross-examination of a motorcyclist. The main purpose may be to bring out the fact that this motorcyclist who ran into a tree limb and is suing the owner of the land, he ran into a tree limb that is put in a road, and the owner of the land was taking this tree limb out to be picked up by the trash collectors the next day. And as the custom in this neighborhood, they put the tree limb right next to the curb. And that's exactly what the owner of the land did. The motorcyclist is going up and down this street, and he cuts the corner, and he hits the tree limb, and he skids on the green leaves, and he goes flying across the street. He slams into a tree. He breaks his back. He's a paraplegic. This is a real case. He sues the landowner for negligence, and negligence by violation of statute because it's in the street, and while it's a custom, it's technically a violation of the local statute, and also for intentional tort. The plaintiff's name is Marty Druick, and he was riding his Yamaha 650 up and down Shadow Bend Road. In his deposition, Marty Druick admitted that he saw this tree limb, admitted he could have stopped. Now, your legal objective is to bring that out. That's a beautiful admission, that he could have stopped. Because by not stopping, by choosing to go around in some fashion and not particularly slow down, but take some evasive maneuver rather than stopping, he chose a riskier path. So obviously you want to get this out, don't you? But this is not the focus. What's Marty's biggest problem? He's on a motorcycle. People don't like motorcycles. This was deliberate on Marty's part. I mean, he didn't accidentally find himself on a motorcycle. God didn't plump him down on the motorcycle right in the middle of the day. It was something that he had planned and executed on his own. He didn't suddenly wake up on a motorbike going down Shadow Bend Road. The focus of this is choice, decision. And the focus of the cross-examination uses the theme word of choice or decide all the way through. Mr. Druick, when you bought that Yamaha 650 model XR2, you had a number of motorcycles to choose from, didn't you? The motorcycle you chose has 5 forward gears, yes, capable of going 65 miles per hour in first. Yes. Capable of doing 90 in second? Yes. I guess so. I don't want you to guess. These are the performance chart from Yamaha. You want to take a look at this? Okay. Motorcycle you chose could go 110 in third. Yes. 140 in fourth? Yes. Topped out at 165 miles per hour in fifth. Yes. This is the motorcycle you chose to be driving on Sunday, April 12, 1990. Yes. You say you're only going 25. Now, his choice already and the performance of this motorcycle make his going 25 somewhat improbable, but that's all right. I mean, that was done for the purpose of bringing that out. Now, Mr. Druick, you chose to go to Shadow Bend Road, which is about 1 hour drive from your home. And you chose to ride up and down Shadow Bend. That's right. Now, when you came down Shadow Bend the last time, there was a limb on the edge of the curb that hadn't been there before. Yes. You saw the limb.
Yes.
And you had a decision, didn't you? Yes. You could have stopped. Yes. If he denies it, you impeach him with his deposition. It's right there. He could have stopped. But you didn't stop. You chose to do something else. Look, you got him choosing to buy a bike. You got him choosing to ride the bike. You got him choosing to go in this neighborhood. You got him choosing a bike that goes this fast. You got him seeing that he can make a stop. You got him deciding and choosing not to stop. You decided to do something else. Yes. You say you chose to go around. Now, you got an eyewitness that says that he chose to jump over it. And that, of course, is very important for you, and you want to ask about that as well. But you see, if your focus is choice, how it's going to drive and create a whole theme for that cross-examination, this doesn't hit brilliant advocates in the middle of trial. They don't say, choice, do it that way. You think about it, and you say, what are the social dynamics of this? When people don't want to see young motorcyclists become paraplegics, on the other hand, they don't particularly identify with motorcyclists. And if they see the raw facts of the amount of power and the speed and the personal decisions that went into picking this bike, deciding to ride it here, claiming he rode it at this low speed, having a decision to make about whether he could stop or do something else to avoid this, and then choosing not to do that, but to take deliberately this other action. Then in final argument, when you talk about responsibilities for the choices that you make, the jury's already there. And the only way that you get that kind of case presented is by the focus sheet, which will have your psychological orientation of the direct or cross on it. And the last thing you look at as you rise to cross-examine Marty Druick is the focus sheet that has the demographics about Marty. It has the principal facts that you must bring out in your cross. You got the outline on the next page, but you got focus choice right there. I want you to do a focus sheet for every witness. It doesn't take scads of time. It's fun. And it's some of the best preparation you'll ever do in your life. You put it in your trial notebook, okay? All right, let's go on from focus. Witness order, organizing the trial. Now, you've all heard of primacy and recency, haven't you? You know that primacy is what comes first, and that primacy has a psychological function in belief. What people hear first, they're more likely to accept as true. And you know why? You know why that's true. You know why it's true because of story theory. Now, once they play it out in their mind, if it fits a script in their mind, they've already provisionally accepted it as true. So as between two competing events, two competing descriptions of an event, both of which with equal plausibility, the one that's heard first, all other things being equal, is more likely to be accepted as being true simply because stories are how we process facts. That means plaintiffs got a great advantage. That means prosecutors got great advantage. That means if you're for the defense and you've got the only burden of proof, If you give up one particular fact that you don't contest, you ought to think about shifting the case around so that you have the advantage of talking first. Primacy, what they hear first, they are more likely to accept as being true, all other things being equal, which they never are. It's a valid psychological phenomenon. It is rarely dispositive, because there are always other competing factors. It's important, but it's not the only point. Recency, what you hear last is easiest to recall. Obviously, avoid needless repetition. Now you have a question. You start with damages or you start with liability? Okay. What about Druick versus Morris? You already know something about Marty Druick, don't you? If you were doing the opening statement in Druick versus Morris, what would you deal with first, liability or damages? Interesting question. There are times when you will start with liability, and there are times when you will start with damages. Liability will be carried a little bit by damages, but not very far. Americans are pretty legalistic. And in fact, lots of juries have more guts to say no than lots of judges do. Judges tend more to cut the baby down the middle and say, okay, you got the right half, you got the left half, go home. Juries don't act that way. They want to decide the case on the basis of right and wrong. And they take responsibility into account. They are legalistic. They are also human. And emotion does make a difference. So damages will carry you a little, but don't count on damages making up for no liability. All right. When you make this decision, think of what the other side is going to do. And of course, your object is to present the story so the jury will want you to win. Okay. Impact. Visual impact. Your theory of the case has got to construct into it what sorts of exhibits, what things need to be explained and what things don't need to be explained. You don't need to explain everything. Only explain what people want to understand and what they must understand. The biggest single problem with lawyers is that they tend to explain everything to the point of nausea, especially with expert witnesses, and it drives juries insane. It is, as I said yesterday when talking about experts, if you were here, you remember, it is that temptation to hate. I had to learn this stuff, and damn it, so will they. That's not true. You had to learn it because you had to be sure that you understood it all. Once you have done that, you're in position to decide what to include and what to leave out. And if you don't comb it and say, we're going to go with the best, we're going to go with the things they really need to understand. And there are other concepts you don't have to define for them. In a fingerprint case, you don't need to go through the history of fingerprinting. All you have to do is put those prints up there, have the arrows that point to the points of similarity, and let the jury look at it and have an expert say, hey, you look at 5 points, you got 5 points of absolute identity, and you got it. See the swirl? See that little dot there? See the cut in the line there? Probably some childhood sort of thing. See how it's identical over here on this other one. And you don't have to go through the history. You don't have to explain everything. You have to explain what they need. Picking the details that count. I was in, I'm hesitant to tell you where it is now, but while I was in a resort hotel for the purpose of giving a program, and after the program, I was having dinner and there was a cocktail pianist playing. Now, it seems to be a disease with them to do a run after every 2 bars. And it's hard to hear the tune. You listen to the jazz greats, you can hear the tune and then you hear the variations and you hear all kinds of wonderful stuff. But the cocktail pianist, there's a flourish every 2 bars. And then they do a little more of the tune. They go, you can't do that. Cut out the flourishes. Stick with the tune. The duck puzzle. The duck puzzle, little girl who couldn't put a duck puzzle together, 3 pieces, she's 6 years old. The duck puzzle was a poignant detail that demonstrated, that showed her brain damage. And the neurologist brought her out, and he examined her in front of the jury and asked her to put the puzzle together, and she couldn't do it. That's the kind of detail that communicates chapter and verse about the brain damage of this little 6-year-old girl. Okay? Marty Druick and the Stain. Marty didn't know his back was broken. He was slammed against this tree and he was semi-conscious and he woke up And he looked and his leg was twisted under him and he didn't feel it. And then he looked and he saw that he had wet his pants. And he did not feel that. That's when he knew he was dead from the waist down. These are details that have impact, okay? Can you take it too far? You bet. Should you? Absolutely not. A lawyer in New York at the turn of the century representing a little immigrant girl, Sarah, who was fascinated by the new electric streetcar. She'd never seen an electric streetcar. She was just off the boat. Little seven-year-old kid. Here was the streetcar, and there weren't any horses pulling it. She hadn't seen anything like that in Minsk. And she was so captivated by it that when it came toward her, she didn't get out of the way quickly enough. It cut off her foot. They sued the electric railway company. The lawyer had the parents save the foot in a mason jar of formaldehyde. And they said, ladies and gentlemen, the electric streetcar company took Sarah's foot. And if you don't believe it, here's the foot. And they hold up this mason jar with this little foot floating around. And the jury goes, ew. Now, you undoubtedly remember Irving Younger saying, what is the law about real evidence or demonstrative evidence? It's admissible unless it makes the jury throw up. Okay? And the Court of Appeals of New York, which is their Supreme Court, said, even in New York, this is too much. Okay? And they reversed. Can you take it too far? Yes. Don't take it too far. Leave the worst parts for the imagination. Which is why plaintiffs who represent severely injured people want them in court long enough for the jury to become uncomfortable with their presence, not long enough for them to become comfortable. 20 minutes, that's about it. You may substitute that with a day in the life of film. Typically, 20 minutes is max for those, too, for the same reason. All right. Demonstrative aids that make this all come alive in your shaping of the theory of the case. Oh, yeah. The chalkboard, the outlines of testimony, the explanation of the interrelationship. Put it up on a board. Have a professional artist, a commercial artist, prepare it for you. Offer it in evidence before trial. Let the other side know you're going to use it. Do it. And there is an example in every USA Today in the lower left-hand corner. There is an example of how to make information instantly understandable through a visual representation. They got a little graph or a little chart. It'll show big workers were more employed, little workers or out-of-work people. You got a bigger one to show there's more out-of-work people. They have a title and a picture, and you understand comparative facts instantly. What I'm telling you is that's very good visual communication. You know that visual communication joins with audible communication for making the most lasting impact. And after all, your job in this entire process is to make an impact that they will remember and want you to win.
This concludes our presentation featuring Professor James W. McElhaney. McElhaney's Master Advocate Series is available exclusively from the Professional Education Group. PEG offers a wide selection of continuing legal education publications, seminars, and both audio and video tapes. For a complimentary catalog, contact us at 12401 Minnetonka Boulevard, Minnetonka, Minnesota 55305. Our toll-free telephone number is 1-800 229-CLE1. We hope that you enjoyed this special presentation by Professor James McElhaney.